Up and down the country, families and small businesses are worried and anxious about their futures, and I know and understand this. Good, strong banks are essential for every family and for every business in the country. And extraordinary times call for the bold and far-reaching solutions that the Treasury has announced today.
That was Gordon Brown announcing on Wednesday that the government is to come to the rescue of the nation's banks with a £500 billion package. I'm Nick Watt and welcome to Politics Weekly. We've reached for our smelling salts here as we come to terms with one of the biggest economic announcements ever made by a British government. We'll be asking where the rescue plan will leave Britain and how it will reshape British and world politics. Joining me to discuss these matters is the Observer's economic guru, Bill Keegan. Hello, Bill.
Hello. Hello, Nick.
We have Polly Toynbee, The Guardian columnist. Hello, Polly.
Hello.
And finally, we have Julian Glover, The Guardian's chief leader writer. Hello, Julian.
Hello.
Now, I'm going to take the brave step of outlining this week's rescue package. Bill is on hand to explain how this will have worked and, of course, to correct me if I get it wrong. So here goes. Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling say there are three strands to their announcement. In the first place, £50 billion will be made available to banks and building societies that want to sell stakes to the government in the form of preferential shares. This is the semi-nationalisation bit of the deal and is known as the recapitalisation of the banks because it will increase their capital and therefore strengthen their ability to lend. In the second place, there will be an extra £100 billion on top of £100 billion already pledged that will be put into a special liquidity scheme for the banks. This will oil the wheels of the banks by allowing them to borrow an extra £100 billion from the Bank of England for short-term loans. In the third place, the government has offered to guarantee loans between banks to the tune of £250 billion. This is designed to unfreeze interbank lending. But it wasn't just Britain that swung into action. There was an aggressive and coordinated cutting of interest rates on both sides of the Atlantic. British rates were cut by a half a point to 4.5%. And the response of our friends in the City of London, a round of applause for the boys in the red braces after they wiped £57 billion off the value of shares. Phew, I made it through that. Now, Bill, how did I do?
10 out of 10, top marks.
Oh, thank you. Now, can I ask you a very simple question? How big was that announcement by the government?
It was huge. And the thing that is still tickling me is that in the morning we were told it was going to be £50 billion. By the time I saw the first Evening Standard hoarding, it was £500 billion. These are indeed strange times. No, it is absolutely vast. And in the 20th century, Keynes rescued capitalism. And now it looks as though capitalism needs a bedrock of socialism to carry on.
So back to the Labour 1983 manifesto. Now, you have written lots of books on British chancellors. When we think of sort of big economic moments in this country in the last 40, 50 years, we think obviously Britain falling out of the ERM in 1992. We think of devaluation of sterling in 1967, the pound in your pocket and all that. Is this up there with these moments, or is it even bigger than those moments?
I mean, it's right up there. The devaluation of the pound in 1967 was obviously big, and the ERM was big. But for me, I was on the Financial Times at the time, the big crisis was the first oil shock of 1973-4, which took everybody by surprise, and the price of oil quintupled. We'd taken oil for granted as something that was cheap. Inflation went up to 28%. That was huge. And there was a recession in the Western world. And people are making lots of historical comparisons at the moment. I think there's been too much talking up of the crisis until yesterday, and I now suspect there may be too much relief. You know, I think there's a long way to go. But this is a great relief to me, and I think the key thing is there was a serious danger, if the system seized up, of these parallels with the 1930s becoming a reality, whereas now I think we're facing something like the 1970s. We will have a recession, but inflation won't be nearly so bad. But we're definitely going to have a recession because there are a lot of things that have been pointing towards that. And this isn't going to avoid a recession.
So it's grim, but we're not going to starve. Now, Polly Toynbee, you are, of course, far too young to remember the 1970s. But let me ask you, are you still standing after that announcement by the Chancellor?
Well, it's pretty astonishing. There they've been accused of dithering. Some of the Conservatives are still saying, of course, they dithered too long, and some of the Conservative commentators. But the remarkable thing is that they are right out ahead of the world and leading the way of probably what a lot of other countries will have to do. And I think that's rather encouraging. We were rather ahead of the world in the bubble, and now we seem to be pointing the way out of it. We weren't quite as bad as Iceland, but we weren't far off.
So, Julian Glover, we have a decisive Prime Minister. Now, you're the chief leader writer of The Guardian, and The Guardian on Thursday described the plan as risky, eye-wateringly expensive, but right.
Yes, I think that's what everybody agrees. It's always slightly worrying when there's a sort of sense of consensus and people say, if this plan is the right one, you always think, well, maybe it isn't. There's something we haven't spotted. But it is the right plan. The Tory party, through gritted teeth, is saying the government's done the right thing. The Lib Dems are saying it. And the question really is what it will do to politics. I know that sounds a bit petty now. We should be thinking of great global things and starvation and recession, but we will get back to politics quite soon. It's amazing to think that it's only just over a week since David Cameron spoke at the Tory conference. A little bit before that, we had the Labour conference, which is deep, distant memory, because we spent a whole time talking about somebody called David Miliband, and goodness, what happened to him? Now, Brown is really a massively strong figure. And the question is, will he be able to use that? Will he be able to sustain it through what's going to be very hard economic times? Or will voters say, well, thanks for the bailout plan. Well done, you've spent a lot of money, but nonetheless, we're all losing our jobs and we'd like you to lose office. Too soon to tell.
Polly, do come in.
Can I just say there are some things that we don't entirely agree about. For instance, the people who've been put in charge of negotiating with the banks about what this deal is going to be, particularly Paul Miners, are themselves all the people who were, in fact, responsible for blowing up this great bubble, who thought it was fine to have, you know, hedge funds, enormous bonuses. They are all people thoroughly imbued with the spirit of the city. Sir James Crosby is looking at mortgages and housing. I think it's time for a real clear out. I mean, all right, I don't think we should send them to jail because they were all in it together, and so were the regulators, and so was everybody who should have been keeping an eye on it. But nevertheless, I do think there should be a clear out, and we need to see new faces striking these deals, people who understand what went wrong. I suspect they want to get back to business as usual, you know, slightly reduced bonuses, but basically the same system. We need something better.
Bill Keegan.
At worst, you could say this is a case of our lending money to the banks, so they won't lend it to us. They will rebuild their balance sheets. I do echo Polly that we must not forget that these people got us into this crisis, and they should not really be forgiven. You know, we need a particular form of financial capitalism has been shown to be absolutely shallow and indeed seriously damaging. And they must not be allowed to go back to their old ways. I was very impressed last night. The first I saw on television was Lord Lawson generously praising the package. And what came back to me was that, although I had my differences with Lord Lawson, I think he was against Mrs. Thatcher. He did not want the building societies demutualised, which was one of the factors that led to this, in the end, to this problem.
Great. Well, we're going to discuss all those matters. But before we do that, we're going to hear from Simon Hoggett, The Guardian's parliamentary sketchwriter, who gives us a flavour of the atmosphere in the Commons when Alastair Darling unveiled his plans to MPs and Gordon Brown appeared at Prime Minister's questions.
Questions to the Prime Minister, Robert...
Simon Hoggart, parliamentary sketchwriter for The Guardian here, just racing up from the House of Commons chamber where we've had Prime Minister's question time, the first of the new session and the first after the banking crisis, and a statement by Alastair Darling about his enormous multi-billion pound rescue package for the banks. Both sides, indeed all three, if you include Vincent Cable, the most effective speaker, deputy leader of the Lib Dems, are saying, oh, well, we're all together in this. We're standing shoulder to shoulder to save the banking system and thence the economy.
I'm grateful for the leader of the opposition's support for the action that we are taking. I hope that we can proceed now on the basis that there will be all-party support for the actions that have been taken today and will be taken in future days.
I don't think backbenchers feel quite the same because, of course, they're absolutely terrified, particularly on the Labour side, that this is not going to help them at all, that they still face being out of work in a year or so. So what we got was both sides of the leadership, Gordon Brown and David Cameron, standing shoulder to shoulder, but the backbenchers keeping up the usual barracking. And, for example, when David Cameron said very firmly, if the government needs to take more major steps, they will have our support, there was loud, sarcastic Labour barracking, bitter barracking.
I'm grateful for
basically what the Labour people feel is that the bankers are effectively Tories, that the Tories are all in favour of an untrammelled free market, that it was Margaret Thatcher who allowed the bankers to take all these risky steps, so they can't stand the idea that it's Cameron, the Tories, who are now standing around saying, oh, well, we're in full support of the government, it's a government of national unity with us behind it. But I think it has to be said that it was a pretty good question time for Gordon Brown, who looked a little bit more in command of things than he has lately. You might call him Now, instead of the pusillanimous procrastinator, which is what he seemed over the past few days and weeks, he's now the dynamic ditherer. He's finally pulled his finger out and done something.
That was Simon Hoggett. So, Polly Toynbee, Simon Hoggett says that Gordon Brown is now a dynamic ditherer. But this crisis has transformed his fortunes, hasn't it? Or has it? Tell me.
Well, it certainly has. He seems very different today than he did 2 weeks ago, or let alone 4 weeks ago. But that just shows us how very fast politics are moving. And I think we've got to be very careful at this point not to say, right, that's a done deal between the public and Gordon Brown. When this crisis, the crisis phase of this is over, there's going to be a long, much sourer mood when, as Bill has said, you know, we're going in for a long and heavy recession. The drama won't be there anymore. You know, they no longer need saviours. It's going to be the hard slog of governing in tough times. And that's the great question, is whether Labour can now seize the mood of the moment, somehow capture it and seem like the people who can handle this best, or whether people turn around and say, well, actually, you were to blame, or whether all across the world people will simply throw out governments who seem to have caused this and Labour gets the backwash from that. I think there is an opportunity there. Has Brown got the imagination to seize it? That's what we need to know.
So, Julian, an opportunity for Labour?
It's a huge opportunity. And I agree with Polly, when the tension falls from this, Brown won't quite look like that commanding figure he saw yesterday. He was brilliant in the Commons. I think he was better than Simon said. He really flattened Cameron, who was not sure what to say at all. He'll lose that moment quite quickly. He'll have to then sustain it through a longer period. And the real challenge for both parties is that the Tory party has spent the last 2 years talking about society and the broken society. Cameron went on about it in his speech last week. He's got to shift now to the broken economy, and there aren't any Tory plans on the broken economy because they sort of thought it wasn't broken. Labour used to have plans on the economy but put them away. It's having to get them out again. So Labour feels now the economy is an area it can talk about much more honestly and openly than the Tories. But both parties really have a guilty secret, which was that they participated in all of the stuff that's gone wrong. And the Tories might have set it up. Labour continued it. Gordon Brown used to fly off to America. He had lots of friends who were bankers. He can't pin all the blame on the Tories on this one.
Bill Keegan, can I ask you, can you answer that question? Is this an opportunity for Labour? Could they come back? I mean, with your historical perspective, if you think of all the governments that have handled these big shocks, Labour devaluation 1967, Ted Heath oil shock 1973, Tories, Britain being chucked out of the ERM in 1992, what happened? They all lost the next election.
Well, but what comes back to me, what comes back to me is Harold Wilson thought he was going to win the 1970 election and lost, thought he was going to lose the 1974 election and won. Hilla Belloc comes to mind too. Always keep a hold of nurse for fear of finding something worse, and that has worked in Gordon Brown's favour recently. And also by bringing Peter Mandelson back, he seems to have silenced the Blairite wing. So he's for the time being in a strong position. But as Polly was saying, there are going to be some tough times ahead, and the question is whether he can see it through. At the moment, I rang Joe Coral recently, and it's 3-1 against Labour.
And Polly, can I just ask you, we seem to be, I mean, the political world seems to have been turned on its head. I mean, yesterday we had David Cameron and George Osborne saying that there should be caps on executive pay for bankers, we shouldn't have any bonuses, and you had a Labour Chancellor lecturing the Conservatives on the dangers of interfering in boardrooms.
Absolutely insane. And for Labour not to seize and move to the left of the Tories every time they concede ground, of course Labour's got to move on, and it's pathetic for them to be standing there. You can see why, because this whole crisis, as we stand really on the edge of an abyss that could still collapse into something really terrible, though it looks less likely, they feel that, you know, banking confidence is the most important thing. Who inspires confidence? Well, other bankers and people who believe in that whole city culture. So you can see why they're so paralysed with fear at doing anything that sounds incredibly left-wing. But I think they could at least do what the Tories advocate. No more bonuses.
Absolutely. It was a bit feeble, that, I thought. And Brown couldn't bring himself to say it. He was probably thinking it. And I guess he's trying to do deals with bankers now and doesn't want to be bashing them. But he should bash them. He's got the cash and they need it.
But Julian, with the Tories saying things like, you know, we should be capping bonuses, is that a sort of a move to the left? Is that them showing that they really don't have a consistent position? Or is it them just being Tories and wanting to look after taxpayers' money?
Well, it's them being an opposition party and doing what oppositions do, which is to pick things apart. It's quite hard for the Tories. I mean, I don't think we should feel sympathy for them. But what do you do as an opposition at this point? You could either say we're just going to go home because there's no point being in opposition, or it causes trouble. Or you ask a series of detailed questions which pick up the minor bits of the plan without looking like you criticise the big plan. And Cameron tried to do that yesterday. The trouble was, as Brown hit him at the end with a quote, Cameron previously said, don't bash the bankers, and then he was there bashing bankers.
Exactly. Bill?
The Tories have lost another rod to beat them with, and that is all this stuff about the fiscal rules and breaking them. Because at a time like this, the last thing you want to do is to raise taxes or cut public spending. So Labour have got off that hook for a time, although they will have to produce some medium-term plan to show that the finances will eventually be sound. Otherwise, they'll be punished again by these fickle markets.
But, Bill, Labour could do one thing, which is to reorganise taxes, not to take more, but they could take more from the very top.
And ease
the pain of people at the very bottom who are really suffering. They could simply shift it around.
Absolutely. And on that, I mean, we haven't polled at The Guardian this week, but we did a poll last week, which I found fascinating, because the split between richer voters and poorer voters and attitudes to the government and attitudes to the response is massive. Before this all happened, pensioners, poor people, rich people all had the same attitude to the Tories. Pensioners were heavily in favour of the Tory economic team. 51% of them thought it was better than the Labour team. That's shifted massively at the bottom end. So pensioners have gone right back to Labour. People at the lower economic groups who are vulnerable have gone back to Labour. Richer people have moved heavily to the Tories. And it's not quite class politics yet. But I think what we'll see is in lots of prosperous southern marginals, Labour will do very badly out of this. In its heartlands, it will do well. And amongst some people like pensioners who do vote, they'll do well as well. But politics is going to be more divided than we've been used to for a long time.
And of course, electorally, that's a calamity for Labour, piling up votes in the seats they've already got.
Labour will lose its majority out of this. Whether the Tories can get one, I don't know.
Now, this financial crisis is not just having an impact politically in this country, it's also having a huge impact across the Atlantic. Polly Toynbee, you are a former Washington correspondent. It seems that Barack Obama seems to be pulling ahead in the polls. John McCain struggling slightly. How do you see this having an impact on the presidential race?
Well, as here, it does look as if the current state of the economy is something that will inevitably benefit the left side of the argument. States need to take action. Regulation is good. Unregulated markets are bad. I think it leaves McCain particularly looking very stuck because the economy isn't his subject anyway. He's relatively uncontaminated by what's happened before, but he just looks as if he's floundering. Nevertheless, I have to say, I'm holding my breath. I think Obama has to be a very long way ahead in the polls before we can say it's a done deal.
Yeah. Bill, can I just ask you, do you think that John McCain and indeed other centre-right parties are exposed now because they, in a sense, believe in a light touch on regulation and look where that got us?
Yes, I do. They ought to be. But what worries me is that American electoral system and the way things are organised. I think it's biased against the Democrat candidate. And whereas I think the Democrats are going to do well in Congress, I'm still nervous about the presidential election.
And it's interesting, Julian, because I was watching, we had the town hall debate between Barack Obama and John McCain the other day, and the media write-ups was essentially that Barack Obama had won, but I watched it the other night, and it was very interesting that McCain seemed to be much more natural with the voters. At one point, there was somebody in the Navy who talked about how he was a retired Navy personnel, and John McCain said, I salute your service, I learned everything that I needed to learn from a chief petty officer, called him by his first name. None of that connection with Barack Obama. How do you see that sort of
thing? Yeah, I watched that moment too, and it's true. I thought McCain looked a bit desperate there. He was just trying to find a friend in the audience. He looked like a slightly anxious, elderly man who'd been thrown in front of a crowd. I thought Obama did all right in that debate. He looked polished. He didn't look frightening. He didn't look risky. He talked about his patriotism. He didn't seem to alarm voters. And I think now he's got to just stay in there, not make a big error, and McCain has got to win by doing something dramatic. There may be an event that happens that changes everything. The financial crash has changed it towards Obama, but it's not solved it. And to go back to polling, I think you're right. The difficulty with polling is, first of all, predicting who's going to vote, and that's a huge trouble with polling in Britain as well. And some people think it may be helping Labour in the polls here because we're pushing Labour a bit further because we think people aren't admitting they're going to vote Labour but will. And maybe Labour's doing worse than the polls are showing here. And in America, are people being racist and just or embarrassed about their racism? And they're saying, oh, of course I'm going to vote for Obama, but on the day they don't. We don't know. We'll find out quite soon.
We will indeed. We'll find out in just a few weeks' time. Well, as we've been discussing, the financial crisis is dominating politics across the world. So we asked The Guardian's business editor, Deborah Hargreaves, to tell us just how serious the world economic crisis is going to be.
I think we are heading into a very, very difficult period for the world economy. I mean, we have lived through a wonderful, wealthy period where we've never had to worry about where our food's coming up from or where our money's coming from. There have been massive periods through history where money, food and energy have been extremely short, and our grandparents can remember that. And I think we'd be facing that again with global warming and with the breakdown of social order that could cause. And I think our children will be living a very different life from the one we live now.
That was Deborah Hargreaves. Bill Keegan, as the Observer's economic guru, I'm going to turn to you first. That all sounds a bit gloomy, but you were saying earlier on that this is more like the 1970s, not the Great Depression of the 30s.
Yes, I really think so. I mean, there was a danger that if the financial system had not, you know, had stayed like that, then there was a real danger. And also, we have learnt something from the 1930s. This concerted intervention by central banks yesterday was pretty impressive, actually. And so, although we had the monetarist diversion and a bias in economic policy, on the whole, I think policy is reasonably Keynesian and reasonably enlightened, and that's going to that will alleviate the situation, but it can't avoid the natural kind of reaction you get in phases of what I'm afraid one has to call boom and bust.
Ah, it's back, boom and bust. Polly Toynbee, you're not as gloomy as Deborah Hargreaves, are you?
No, as a baby boomer, I've lived all my life with apocalyptic fears. We were told that the H-bomb would go off for sure. One thing after another we've had, recently we've had, the millennium bug was going to bring everything to a complete halt. We still have the fear of avian flu. I think perhaps we always have to live with the idea that we live on the very edge and the whole thing could always collapse. Perhaps we rather enjoy those thoughts and we play with them quite, how would I manage if we went back to sort of caveman existence? I doubt it myself. We've lived through all the rest. I think somehow we'll just be sane enough not to let that happen.
So no Flintstones life for us, Julian Glover. But obviously there's going to be a reordering of priorities, a reordering of government spending. I mean, things like climate change, we're all a bit worried about that. That needs huge government action. Are we going to be able to deal with that?
I think the climate change point's really important. And this week, had we not had the financial crisis, which is obviously dominating everything, we might have been talking about climate change in this discussion, because we had a report on Tuesday from a debt earner who, in his other hat, was popping into Downing Street to rescue the financial system, which called on the government to make the 2050 target 80%, not 60%, and that would then bring forward all of the other cuts that are needed. We've got a new climate change minister, who's Ed Miliband, who's very enthusiastic, and he's got a department and wants to push the agenda. We've got a new lineup in the opposition as well of people who want to push that. And in Europe, we had a vote where the European Parliament voted to spend 10 billion euros, I don't know where they get it from, on carbon capture technology. Massive stuff. We had a huge discussion of green issues in the European Parliament this week. Real votes, real power there. Normally we laugh at the European Parliament, but they took some big decisions and they took concerted decisions across Europe. It really still is out there as an issue. Whether it destroys life as we know it, we'll wait and see. I suspect in Britain it won't, and in Africa it will, and that's the sad truth of climate change.
Now, Bill Keegan, the reason why we're obviously having to reorder priorities is if we're stumping up 500 billion, some of that's got to be paid for. You were saying, obviously, the government is not going to increase taxes. It's not going to cut dramatically public spending, so there's only one other way to do it. That's borrowing. What is the impact on public finances?
It's important to note that a lot of that 500 billion, it is hoped, will not be spent. And it's easy to have fun with this government's accountancy practices. But as far as I understand it, the Office for National Statistics so far doesn't think that a lot of this should count as borrowing.
Oh, can you just say that again? Because the front page of the Daily Mail this week said £16,000 for every household. Must have scared
the living daylights out of me. That is assuming the absolute worst. You know, a lot of this is there in case, and it does seem to have had a good effect on morale. So I think there's some... this is wild speculation about that. But if the worst did come to the worst, then it would have an effect on the finances. I think this is absolutely necessary to do this. But I'm hoping, and I don't believe it'll all be called on at all.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the government says that the money that it provided for Northern Rock is not only being paid back, it's being paid back ahead of time.
Yes.
Do we have any idea whether we'll get it all back? Whether, the taxpayer might even make a profit? Do we know that? How long will it take?
We don't know it, but there's a reasonable chance, I think. And I think 26 billion of Northern Rock has already been paid back, yes. It's these scary headlines. I know we're members of the press, but they don't do anybody any good.
And Polly, can I just ask you, you are noted as one of the great pro-Europeans at The Guardian. How do you see sort of concerted European Union activity at the moment? I mean, it's interesting that we had that sort of transatlantic cut in interest rates, the Federal Reserve in the US, the Bank of England in the UK and the ECB in Europe. But we did have that summit of the four big European powers last weekend. They all said, let's work together. And then Angela Merkel went home and announced that she was going to protect all retail deposits in Germany. And she didn't tell her European chums. How's that all working out, do you think?
I think Europe looks pretty bad. I think that, you know, Ireland's behaviour has been atrocious, first of all in voting against and then in going it alone and becoming a kind of offshore tax haven, undercutting everybody else. I think if Europe wants to hold together through this, it's going to have to get a lot more authoritarian with its own members. It's simply going to have much stricter rules, and it's going to have a mechanism for imposing them. You can't have every small country deciding to go it on its own and undercut bigger countries in tax. I think it does mean a measure of tax harmonisation. Yes. For the first time, that's not unthinkable. If you'd said that, whispered that before, Brown would have been horrified, I think, and the Tories would have been horrified. I think the anti-Europeans will be trounced on this, and it'll have to happen. And if not, it'll all fall apart.
Julian Glover is nodding.
Well, the great trouble for Europe now is its size. It has big countries and little countries, and it has rich countries and poor countries, and it has East and West. When it began, it was a club of pretty prosperous Western European industrial states who could have worked together on things like this. Now, what's good for Latvia, what's good for Estonia, maybe even what's good for Ireland and Iceland's talking about coming in now, I don't know, we want them, isn't necessarily what Germany wants. And so countries don't feel that they'll get anything out of a concerted sort of joint decision, so they make their own, and that's a danger.
Bill, let me just ask you, Polly was saying there that we need tax harmonisation, which is obviously talking about potential common fiscal policy across the European Union. Well, we haven't even got into the common monetary system, so that's a few steps down the road, isn't it?
I mean, you won't, I like the theory, you won't get that from Gordon Brown, and I fear that Gordon Brown would probably rationalise this as justifying his approach. You know, he's tended to turn up at meetings late and leave early, and he offended a lot of people in Brussels. But as far as he was concerned, what mattered was establishing good relationships with people like President Sarkozy. And he seems to have been doing a lot of telephoning to Sarkozy in recent days. And so he probably thinks that his practice of having good relations with the people at the top but not being too keen on the European institutions has paid off. But I would rather think that out of this comes a much more determined effort at a better functioning Europe.
Do you not think we could have a minimum corporation tax rate across Europe? Would that be impossible? Because that's really where the competition is.
Yes, and it does relate to this financial crisis. I mean, they've all been too scared to take on tax dodgers. I think that would be a good approach, and there'd be public support behind it. I mean, what terrifies Gordon Brown, of course, is the sort of the English anti-European feeling. But there should be support for this, and I think that would be a good place to start.
Before we start lecturing Europe, we might just think that Britain is responsible for many of the tax havens around the world, starting with the Channel Islands. We might just start including them in the European Union and taxing them properly as well.
But, Bill, when we say that Gordon Brown is a bit sniffy about the European Union and it's difficult to see how we would want to sort of integrate even further, that was an attitude of Gordon Brown in the 90s and the early part of this decade when things were going well. Things are now not going well. And the last time that Britain really embraced the European Union, not that it was called that then, the EEC, 1975, big yes vote, and we did that because we were terrified of being the sick man of Europe. Maybe we could revive the spirit of 1975.
Extremely good point. 10 out of 10 again, I'd say. I mean, the people who want to join the euro are waiting for a crisis when we go in. We always tend to do things when things are going badly here, and certainly the crowing has stopped. I mean, it was embarrassing, the crowing that went on during 10 years of Gordon's chancellorship. It was ill-judged, in my opinion.
I just about remember that referendum in 1975. Polly, do you think that's the sort of spirit that we could be moving towards?
I think we could. I think that the door has opened if Labour has the imagination and the daring to seize it. I'm not sure that they will. I'm not sure that we've got the sort of imaginative leadership that's capable of it or that feels it has the power. After all, you know, essentially, as Julian said from our polls, Labour's still in a very weak position. And it's quite different to reconfigure the political landscape from a non-dominant position. So I'm not optimistic, and yet I do think there's a chance, and possibly it's the chance for Labour to save itself by being brave. But they should be calling in people like Bill and Will Hutton and Larry Elliott to be their advisers, not the bankers.
Oh, no, after nearly 40 years of independent journalism, I'm staying out of that, Polly. Thank you very much, though.
On that note, from one of the wise men of Farringdon Road, thank you very much. That's it from this week's edition from Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, the Observer's economic guru Bill Keegan, the Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee, and the Guardian's chief leader writer Julian Glover. Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again next week. Till then, goodbye.